He was 17, and the charge was armed robbery, and they put him into adult court. I think that if he'd been in juvenile court, he would have gotten better representation, and people would have heard his story better. So I think that would have made a huge difference.
And he, like it was funny, he laughed. He actually laughed like it was a joke. And he said, "Nigga, you're gonna serve that 20 years." The first time I went up for parole, I was told that for me to actually be paroled, one of the requirements is that I had to explain to them, to the parole commission, what happened in the commission of my crime and what, how do I feel about what I did. I said, "Well, I didn't commit this crime. I didn't do this."
When one thinks of Baltimore, you might think of Francis Scott Key and the Star-Spangled Banner, or the world-renowned John Hopkins Medical Center. But in recent years, Baltimore's image has taken a battering. It's become a city whose reputation has become overshadowed by its problems. Police corruption, urban violence, and a political system immune to reform. Those problems were laid out in the fictional HBO series, The Wire.
"I'm just a humble motherfucker with a big-ass dick. You give yourself too much credit."
"Okay, then. I ain't all that humble."
"You know what the most dangerous thing in America is, right? Nigga with a library card." "What the fuck?"
And, of course, Baltimore is the scene unfolding real-life criminal justice dramas such as Adnan Syed and Freddie Gray. For Leslie Vass, the injustice of the Baltimore justice system is all too real. He was convicted of armed robbery in a bench trial by the Baltimore Circuit Court in 1975. Leslie Vass was exonerated 10 years later at the age of 28. What happened in between is a tragic tale filled with determination, courage, and many obstacles.
"I grew up here in the South Baltimore area. We lived in a housing development called Westport, which was in the inner city. The families at that time, you know, the attitude of families and neighbors was completely different than what we see now. As a child growing up, you know, the people that lived in the community were also your family members, you know. They looked out for you. You didn't have to worry about a bunch of shootings and, you know, random killings of kids and all because of the things that was taking place that you see happening now. Children were children. They were able to play the little games and, you know, have a life as a child. And then, you know, I used to go to the pharmacy. It's called the Westport Pharmacy on Annapolis Road here in Baltimore, an area where I lived in for 10 years prior to this happening. And went in, I made a purchase for my mom's February the 15th, 1975. I purchased a newspaper, which was a usual thing she wanted me to get. I left out and I was standing waiting across the street to come back towards my home, when a police officer came out of the back of the pharmacy building, which is where the liquor store department was at, pointing a gun at the people standing at the corner. It was me and like two other fellows standing there. And when he was pointing a gun, I stepped down because I knew he couldn't have been telling me I hadn't done anything, you know. I just came from out the store. I spoke to Doc, who was the owner of the store. That's what we knew him as. And he said, "You with the leather jacket on, with the tan leather jacket, go put your hands up against the wall." I pointed to myself because I had on a tan leather. The other fellas had on a black coat and another kind of coat. So I pointed at myself and he said, "Yeah." I said, "What'd I do?" He said, "Go put your hands up against the wall." So I did that. You know, 17 years old, never had any kind of interaction with the police. I had heard about incidents where, you know, people, the youth were, youth at that time were doing things, and Baltimore City had a particular policy of the juvenile problems, right, that they was having. So I didn't want to become a victim, because someone, I think something happened in the community just prior to my arrest where a person was accidentally shot by a police officer because the officer tripped and the gun went off. At that time, they had revolvers, right? So my first and foremost thought was, I don't want to be a victim of getting killed by a police by an accident. When I went and put my hands against the wall, I heard him say, "Is this the man?" And someone said behind me, because he made me keep my head facing the wall with the gun behind me. He said, "Is this the man?" And I heard a voice say, "Yeah, it looks like him."
Standing there with his hands against a wall, a police officer's gun trained on his back and robbery victim pointing at him, the course of Leslie Vass's life was irreparably changed. The 17-year-old was no longer known as the standout high school basketball player. He was an armed robbery suspect. Nevitt Steele, a friend of Leslie's and a veteran Baltimore attorney, said the first thing prosecutors sought to do was strip Leslie of his juvenile status.
He was 17, and the charge was armed robbery, and they put him into adult court. I think that if he'd been in juvenile court, he would have gotten better representation, and people would have heard his story better. So I think that would have made a huge difference.
Leslie's mother was a school janitor. She dug into her savings and hired the best private attorney she could afford for her son.
Everybody claimed that this attorney was a great attorney and that he, you know, was winning a lot of cases. So my mom actually scuffled to pay this man to represent me. As I said, I was arrested February 15th, 1975. I used to go see him. She obtained him like the week following that. When she obtained him, she told me, "Do what the lawyer tell you to do, because he knows the law, and that's what I'm paying him for, to represent you." Wait, let me go outside. It was pouring down rain out here now. So he, I would go see him, and at the times that I would, the first thing that he would say to me was, "Did your mother send me a check?" You understand? Never did he explain to me anything pertaining to the case, what happened, or anything. He asked me, I remember one time asking me a question, "Did I know a fella named Joe Lewis?" And I said, "No." I said, "A boxer?" I said, "I don't know him personally." I said, "But that's the only one that I've ever heard of named Joe Lewis." He said, "How about a Claude Knight?" I said, "No, I don't know these people. Who are they?" Right? So he said, "They just, you know, some people that supposed to have been with you." Right? And I said, "What you mean with me?" So he said, "You know, you're charged with armed robbery of a part-time delivery driver." And I said, "Part-time delivery driver?" I said, "Who are you talking about, Mr. Klein?" So I said, "Mr. Klein and the other man, Mr. Willie, I know them. They know I didn't rob them, right?" And I said, "What are you talking about, the day that they arrested me?" He said, "No, this robbery happened November the 2nd, 1974. Now I'm totally thrown out of whack, because November the 2nd, 1974 is almost 4 months prior to me being arrested.
But this attorney turned out to be a poor choice.
Oh, well, I don't know, the guy was prejudiced, and there was you know, post conviction proceedings, and he used the N word in talking to Leslie. I don't know. I mean, I think he was very, very biased, and. There's a lot of, you know, discriminatory stuff happening in that circuit court. You know, we had a huge police problem, and the state's attorney's office is overwhelmed, And again, you know, from my point of view, they got no business charging people who are under 18, that they ought to go into the juvenile system and there'd be less people, less volume there.
He said, look, when they ask you what kind of trial you want, you're supposed to say trial by judge. And now I'm just looking at this man and I'm saying to myself, I just have a feeling. My intuition is saying to me something's wrong. Something's wrong. Where's my mind? I don't know what to do. I say, okay. Well, when they found me guilty, they revoked my recognizance. And they had to fight with me to get me out of the courtroom because I couldn't understand why I was being arrested for something I didn't do. And, you know, it was like, all this has now become a dream. I cannot believe that this is going on. They take me to what they call Baltimore City Jail here. And, you know, they're slamming doors and people screaming and howling and cells and all this stuff. Man, things I have never, ever, ever seen.
Weeks later, Leslie reappeared in court and, despite never having had a prior arrest, was sentenced to 20 years in prison. His mother sat in the courtroom astonished.
And I said to this attorney, I said, so he said he told her not to come because it was going to be bad. And that he had told her that because of them finding me guilty, the judge was going to sentence me to 20 years. I said, 20 years for what? 20 years for armed robbery. And he, like it was funny. He laughed. He actually laughed like it was a joke. And I said to him, I said, you know, I said, you did this. You did this. You know, and he said, nigga, you're going to serve that 20 years.
The teenager was not prepared for life in prison.
Going into this Maryland State Penitentiary is a, how can I put it, traumatic experience. All you hear is doors slamming, bam, 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 people screaming and howling, yo, what's up, what you doing? Boy, send that down to me. All you hear is those kind of things, right? And you're looking around, and all you see is madness. People running here and there, guys running around. I see guys with dresses on. I'm saying to myself, what's going on here? What kind of place they put me in? You know, we take a shower, they give you a jumpsuit, and then lock you in a cell. So I was put in A125. I get in the cell. The fellow that's already in there, he's on the bed on the bottom bunk. And he like, sure, they said, you okay? He said, I can't take the top bunk, bro, because the police shot me and I can't climb up.
While in prison, he tried to improve his situation through education, but that didn't help him before the parole board.
I applied to take my GED test because I didn't get to graduate, you know. I never got a high school diploma. I never got the chance to actually participate in graduating. You know, things that teenagers do once they reach a certain age, you know. I enrolled in a program, a paralegal certification program there at the Maryland State Penitentiary that was being taught by the professors from the University of Baltimore School of Law and the University of Maryland Law Schools. They had professors come in and was teaching us the procedures and steps on how to actually address your criminal conviction. I also was taking sociology, started learning about sociology, and I became more adjusted to being where I was at because I realized that I was going to have to do what I have to do. That means serve the sentence. The first time I went up for parole, I was told that for me to actually be paroled, one of the requirements is that I had to explain to them, to the parole commission, what happened in the commission of my crime and how do I feel about what I did. I said, well, I didn't commit this crime. I didn't do this. I had nothing to do with this. I knew nothing about this. I had no idea that this was ever taking place, none of that. And they said, well, you can't be released on parole because you have to admit your guilt to this before we can actually consider you for parole. I said, well, that's not happening. They sent me back to my cell. And when I got back to my cell, I was just, you know, I just realized that, you know, the only way that I was going to be able to do this was for me to do what I need in the judicial system to give this sentence back to them. And that's what I started working on. I got my original police offense report. I got the Abundant Freedom Information Act. I got all of the documentation pertaining to this case, dog, on what happened. Found out that these men were at a Baltimore City jail program called the CASH program, which was a drug program, and that the two men that actually were arrested and admitted commission of the crime were at the drug program together and had came home on the weekend when they committed this robbery, and then he went back over to the jail. And that Monday or Tuesday after they committed it is when the police actually got the information and they found out that they were over the jail, and they went over there and placed what they call detainers against them and charged them with this armed robbery. That was even before I was ever arrested. Things I had no knowledge of that transpired in court. When I contacted the attorney, Mr. Conrad, to send me any documentation that he had about any motions or that he filed, because I was looking at the ineffective assistance of counsel thing to file against him for my direct appeal. He refused to send me anything. You know, so I ended up getting someone else, the fellows in the class, and taught me how to go about it a roundabout way. And I got the clerk of the court to send it to me, a copy of the file.
During the next 10 years, Leslie is repeatedly denied parole because he refused to take responsibility for a crime he did not commit. But his salvation came in the form of another inmate who walked up to him while he was playing basketball in a prison yard.
So he said, come back here, I'm going to give you a picture of my brother. He the one that they mistake you for. And this fellow, what he did was he started telling me about the robbery that happened and that Bucky Nutt was the one that the people had mistaken me for. But the detectives that was in charge of investigating the robbery, a man named Detective Fisher and another detective named Nelson, right, were in charge of investigating the robbery. Bucky Nutt was an informant for these two detectives. So I'm looking at this guy, and I that's one of the main things that you learn when you first get inside the jail. You don't tell nobody about your case because these dudes is cruddy. They will use the information, set you up to, and tell people stories that you supposedly told them you committed these crimes and all that. So I really didn't give him no information. He told me things that I had never knew about my case until after I actually got enrolled in the program and started getting the documentation. So I knew that this guy's information was correct. Right. I took that information, that photograph, and I wrote a letter to the director of the public defender's office, because at the time I had filed a petition, 1983 civil rights violation with the federal courts, a 1983 suit about my conviction. And I put in there all the different arguments and contentions that I did, because I had exhausted my state remedies. The attorney that my mother paid to do my appeal wrote the appeal, submitted the appeal, was denied, and then sent me a letter telling me that he had actually been retained by my mother to do my appeal.
He lost his appeal, but he kept fighting for his freedom.
The letter said that the investigator from the public defender's office had taken the photograph that I sent to them and located the victim of the robbery. showed the victim the photograph that I supplied to them, and the victim positively identified the man on the photograph as being the person who actually robbed him and asked, how's he out of jail? And the investigator said that they told him, he's not out of jail. That's not the man that you sent to jail. And he said, oh my God, I made a mistake and I'm sorry, you know.
Soon he appeared before a Baltimore judge who listened to the testimony of the victim and then dismissed Leslie Vass's conviction. Leslie had lost a decade of his life serving time for a crime he did not commit.
They threw out the conviction. They had it down as just as a court release, right? Then they, when I actually looked at the paperwork and stuff that they gave me, it was like, well, you granted release, a court release, and you served 10 years of a 20-year sentence. And they gave me the balance of my money that was in my account, which was $160, right? That was the money that I had in my commissary account, right? And that next morning, they got me out of the jail. I was standing outside the jail using the telephone that on the wall beside the front door to the Merrill House Correction, calling my mother, telling her that I had been released. I was granted a court release, and now I was outside the jail, and could she come pick me up, you know? First, she thought I was joking. She said, what you did? She said, you ain't run away from that place, did you? I said, Mama, I got a court release. I said, I want a court release. And she said, what is that? I said, Mama, can you come pick me up? She said, yeah, I'll be there. I'll be there to get you. All right. Where are you at? I said, I'm in front of the Merrill House Corrections, the jail that you last visited me at. She said, okay. But she came and got me.
In March of 1987, the Maryland Board of Public Works awarded Vass $250,000 in damages over 6 years. For 12 years, Maryland failed to expunge the armed robbery conviction from Vass's record, despite orders to do so from two judges in 1986 and 1993. He was later arrested on a charge of attempted murder, and the judge refused to grant him bail because the previous crime remained on his record. He sat in jail for a year awaiting trial. Once the case went to trial, the jury quickly found him innocent.
The state didn't present anybody to actually testify in this case except the victim and the fellow that was supposedly with her. And when they got on the stand, different things that were said, I mean, it was just really crazy. It was like, you know, stories are being made up as they go along.
Folks, I don't know about you, but I'm always looking for something healthy to eat. And the problem is, I don't always eat healthy. If it was left up to me, I'd be sitting in front of the TV eating corn chips. And that's because I don't plan very well. And it's an effort to go out and to store and hunt down healthy things to eat. But hey, you can get healthy things delivered to your home to dine on. And these aren't meals. These are just snacks, healthy snack food. What a concept. The company I'm talking about is Hungry Root. They were founded back in 2015. Hungry Root is a brand of healthy comfort food. They take foods that people associate with indulgence and lack of health and reinvent them using vegetables and other wholesome ingredients. And they'll deliver them to your house every week. Think of them as the healthy convenience food company. They deliver weekly boxes of foods that customers can use to make a variety of inspiring, delicious dishes. All their food is plant-based and gluten-free. Their meals come either ready to eat or ready in less than 10 minutes. Customers can choose to make the dishes according to the recipes that are provided or mix and match ingredients for additional flexibility. They offer over 75 dishes that customers can make at home, like sweet potato pad thai, made from sweet potato noodles, spicy peanut sauce, and snap peas. I'm just saying, that is just absolutely delicious. And then there's the almond chip pea cookie dough. I can't wait to serve this up for my three daughters. They love ice cream. And the idea that I could fool them and get them to eat something healthy that they're also going to think is indulgent, I just think is so awesome. And you can even eat it straight from the container, folks. There are no commitments to working with Hungry Root. You can skip a weekly box when you don't need it. And folks, there are just so many people out there that love it. It's gotten a 4.6 Facebook rating. You can't do much better than that. It is just exceptionally popular. And guess what? Because you're listening to Suspect Convictions, you can save $25 off on your first two orders, a $50 saving, by using the code SUSPECT at checkout. To get started, go to hungryroot.com. That's $25 each of the first two orders using SUSPECT at checkout. Once again, folks, go to hungryroot.com and enter the code SUSPECT to get $25 off on your first two orders. I'm just saying, go for it. You're going to enjoy this food. It's really good. I remember the first day I looked into my oldest child, Grace's, eyes. She cooed and cried as she snuggled in the crook of my arm. It was humbling. I was a parent, and this little one depended on me. After her birth, I started eating better and exercising. I wanted to be there for her, and now her two sisters. But what if something happened where I was unable to be there to support her? Well, that's why term life insurance makes sense to me. I'm particularly intrigued by Haven Life Insurance Agency. You don't have to go to somebody's office or get on the phone to buy a policy. You can apply over the internet. It's quick, easy, and convenient. We buy clothes, books, and groceries online. Why not life insurance? Haven Life offers term life insurance coverage issued by Massachusetts Mutual Life Insurance Company, a 160-year-old industry leader. It's not only convenient to buy, but it's also affordable. For example, a 35-year-old woman in excellent health can buy a 20-year, $500,000 policy for $18 per month. But importantly, life insurance gives you the peace of mind that your family will be financially cared for in the event that you aren't there to help do it yourself. To get a free quote, head to welcome.havenlife.com/suspect. That's welcome.havenlife.com/suspect. Get a free quote today. Well, folks, we're joined today by Stephen Janis, a very distinguished journalist from Baltimore who has a great deal of experience covering the Baltimore Police Department and their judicial system. Welcome, Stephen.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, Stephen, I sent you some background information here on this case. What was your impression when you went through it?
Well, it's astounding in one sense. You would think we have expectations about a criminal justice system that there is checks and balances and a sense of fairness. But this case is astounding that he had to go through this situation not once but twice. But, you know, it's interesting because there's actually an aspect of the 70s criminal justice system that is become relevant today, which is, I think, related to this case, which I don't know, the Unger decision, which was a big, big problem. Maryland was one of the last states to have this jury instruction where juries were told to ignore the law, basically, that they were the final finders of both facts and law, and that, you know, it was up to them. So things like presumption of innocence didn't matter. And that case has come back to haunt a lot of cases from the 70s because the Maryland Court of Appeals finally ruled that was unconstitutional. And so a lot of people who were convicted recently in 2012 were given new trials because they were denied due process. But Maryland was one of the last states to continue that practice up until the early 80s. And that's just one of many elements of our criminal justice system that I think makes these kind of cases possible, as really unbelievable as they seem. You know, we had a long history of a policy called zero tolerance in the aughts during the administration of Martin O'Malley, where hundreds of thousands of people were arrested, ultimately determined to be illegally. And we had a Justice Department report which found the Baltimore Police Department for decades participated in racist and unconstitutional practices. And, you know, we also had the Freddie Gray death in police custody, which caused an uprising. So the criminal justice system in this city has constantly been under siege as being unfair. And I think it's vested quite strongly in the racial disparities and the racial segregation that has defined this town. I mean, when you look at the reports that you see on the criminal justice, on the Unger decision, for example, or you look at the report from the Justice Department, it primarily affects African Americans and almost all poor African Americans. I mean, there was one gentleman in the Justice Department report who was arrested 44 times for for charges like trespassing or walking while African American, frankly. So to me, this case embodies many of the, you know, structural issues that have been plaguing the city for decades. And, you know, the basic, especially in the African-American community, mistrust of the fairness of the criminal justice system.
I got to say, when I was interviewing Leslie and I was talking to other folks, I had this inkling in the back of my mind. I kept thinking about that HBO series, The Wire. It didn't paint Baltimore mm-hmm. police in a very positive light. I mean, obviously that's fiction, but how close to reality is it?
Well, I would say, and this is just my opinion as a person who's actually covered police, that The Wire treads lightly on police. I mean, people say, wow, look at all these things that they've done. But, you know, we just recently had a scandal with a unit called the Gun Trace Task Force. And the Gun Trace Task Force was a supposedly elite unit of officers whose job it was to take guns off the street. Well, it turned out that they were operating, I don't want to say rogue, but they were operating with impunity. They were robbing drug dealers, robbing residents, kidnapping people, taking them to off-sites, impersonating federal prosecutors. They were stealing overtime, getting overtime pay while they were at home working on their house or while they were on vacation. They were dealing drugs. They were dealing drugs. In fact, in 2015, when our former commissioner, Anthony Batts, said that the cause of the surge of violence in the uprising was from prescription pills stolen from Rite Aid during the looting, it actually turned out that one of the officers from the Gun Trace Task Force had taken that OxyContin, and he was dealing it. So, you know, you look at The Wire, and actually I think it portrays the police in a pretty good light, relatively speaking. I mean, I know that people are going to say that's absurd. The Wire was trenchant. But, you know, when you look at, if you had sat through the trial of the Gun Trace Task Force, you'd be stunned. And they were doing this all with the tacit acknowledgement of the command staff. In other words, there was testimony during the trials of several of the officers that the police commissioner knew about the overtime, where they would say, if you get a gun, everyone can go home, but you still get 8 hours of overtime. And then, of course, The Wire also missed, glossed over the zero tolerance that I just talked about. I mean, that was a definitive criminal justice strategy of the Baltimore City Police Department for almost 7 or 8 years. 100,000 people arrested for quality of life crimes. You know, it was sort of a improvisation on the New York City experiment with this, but it turned into just a policy where they would just literally go, and there were people known as the jump out boys who would go into African-American neighborhoods and just hoard people into the back of a van to say, get in the back of the van, you're going down to Central Booking, just to get their stats. So I think The Wire is a great television show, but I don't think it depicts at all the issues, true issues within the Baltimore City Police Department and how bad it's been. I mean, I just went to a meeting with a monitor, the federal monitor, who is actually charged with supervising our consent decree, which we have with the Justice Department, to reform the department. And he said that the police department is quote, completely dysfunctional. So I think The Wire actually makes them look pretty good, relatively speaking, to what I've seen as a reporter on the ground.
So one of the things that kept going through my mind here is, you know, this guy got a full pardon. He got two judges to order expungements, and yet they never expunged it from his record. I mean, is that what's the cause of that? Is it, are we dealing with racism? Are we dealing with government neglect? Are we dealing with indifference? Well, what are we dealing with?
Well, let me give you an example of why expungement's been a big controversial issue. You know, when I was writing about police brutality in the aughts, especially in the early aughts when other people weren't writing, there was one sort of instrument that the police establishment and the police infrastructure criminal justice system have, which is a criminal record. So some guy said to me, you know what, this cop pulled me over and they beat me up and I didn't do anything wrong. The first thing the police would shoot back to me and said, yeah, but look at his record. He's got X, Y, Z. You can't trust this person. The arrest record and the record of criminality is like the currency of power for the established criminal justice system. They use it to limit people's opportunities. They use it to limit people's personal efficacy in terms of the political system. And they use it to be able to, you know, make sure that no one can really push back on some sort of their misbehavior. I mean, I think they're very reluctant to, you know, allow people to, you know, expunge your record. And there's a certain sense of, you know, once you're in this system, we're not going to let go of you. You know, I've watched in the past 6 months, two people, you know, walk out of jail who were wrongly convicted of murder. And just recently, this man, I think his name is Johnson, was just released. He'd served 30 years for a crime he didn't commit. And when he was going to come out before the media, he wanted to change his shirt. He didn't want to wear the coveralls. He wanted to put on a regular civilian clothes. And the sheriff inside the jail wouldn't let him change. So he had to come out, and his family had to stand around him while he put on his shirt. Now, that's somewhat tangential, but it's sort of symbolic. I don't think they like to let people go once they have you in that system. It's too much power. There's too much money at stake in Baltimore.
So Baltimore has I hate to say this, a really horrible reputation nationally. I mean, you hear about all these cases. I mean, you know, Adnan Syed brought a lot of attention with a serial podcast to problems in that area. I mean, is there what makes Baltimore unique from other judicial systems or in other cities, or is it unique?
Well, I think, you know, what happened with the criminal justice system is sort of, it has evolved. You know, Baltimore City was one of the first cities to institutionalize or legalize segregation on the early 19th century or 20th and beginning of the 20th century. And I think when Baltimore started to integrate and there were tensions and there were problems, that the criminal justice system here became sort of an enforcer of segregation, but not through, you know, as the laws changed and became illegal. I think through the, you know, institution of policing and criminal justice became a way to impose the kind of invisible barriers that people didn't want to explicitly state existed. So I think that, to a certain extent, corrupted the criminal justice. For example, we're one of the few states that still does not allow television cameras in the courtroom. I mean, I think there are four or five, but we're just one of few. And you have to ask your question, why? Well, you know, I think it's because there's a well-established, factually established racism in the criminal justice system. I don't think our system wants people to see it. So I think the reputation is well deserved, and the reputation has been earned. And, you know, just anyone, I urge anybody who wants to understand Baltimore in terms of how policing operates in terms of racism, go online and type in Justice Department, Baltimore City Police 2016, and read it. It's 166 pages. It documents the history, and it documents, you know, both current and past history. And I think it's become an institution that is well known to be the government intervention into the segregation problem that has existed in this city for almost a century.
So we talked about this a little bit on our earlier phone call, but how much is racism a problem within the police department itself?
Right. Well, in 2008 or 2004, a Baltimore police sergeant, Lewis Hobson, filed a landmark civil rights case against the Baltimore City Police Department. And the basic allegation was that the white command staff had used had used the internal disciplinary system to prevent promotion of police officers, black police officers in the city. There are, you know, somewhere along the lines of 40%, 50% African-American officers. But in the past, the command staff has been predominantly white. And what the lawsuit alleged was that that was purposeful, that black officers were subjected to much more severe discipline than white officers. And what it resulted in was a predominantly white command staff. When I was writing about them in the late aughts, the command staff was 66% white. And you got to understand, Baltimore is a town that is 63 to 64% African-American. So allegations of racism, and especially the prevention of promotion of black officers to positions of leadership, have been a constant allegation. And it's been a problem. I mean, you know, I remember back in like 2010, I was running with the police department, and we have 9 police districts throughout the city. So there's like, you know, it's sort of like a mini command staff that's called the district, and they have their own district headquarters and district commanders. And like 7 of the district commanders were white. So it's very, I would say, not proportionate to the population. And I think that, you know, Hobson finally won the lawsuit and the city agreed to make changes. And there have been changes. But certainly in the past, it has been very difficult for black officers to be promoted. And that's really what's important, to be in the command staff. That's where you can really make a difference.
So what about the legal system? Is there some endemic issues there as far as race? I mean, as far as lawyers, mm-hmm. judges, the system itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the one thing that you have to remember about the justice system in Baltimore is how expansive it is and how many people it criminalizes and how predominantly that's African Americans. When I talked about the zero tolerance policy, 90% of the people who were arrested during the zero tolerance era in Baltimore were African American, whereas the city's population is, like I said before, like 64%. Recently, as of 2010-11, when I was doing an investigation of marijuana arrests, 90% of the people arrested for minor marijuana crimes were African American, whereas the population of the city is 64% African American. So the justice system is constantly bringing people into its institutions. And so it is constantly informed by this idea of race, where, well, all we're seeing is African American people in our court. All we're seeing is African American people in handcuffs. So I think it becomes in itself like an institutional manufacturer of racist attitudes. And so it's impossible for it not to be racist because of the way the system works and the people that it affects.